This is Spectrum.
Alternative Medicine. Homeopathy. Secret Society. Hypnosis. The Paranormal. Alternative Energy. UFO. Abduction. The Weird. The Wild. And the Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis. And remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good, buddy. Good. What do we got? What do we got this week?
Our guest tonight is Frank Zendarsik, who graduated from the University of Pittsburgh with a BS in electrical engineering in 1975. He's currently a registered professional engineer in the state of Pennsylvania. In the 1980s, he went on to obtain an AS in business administration at St. Francis College. He studied physics in the University of Indiana in the 90s, and Frank has been employed as an engineer in the steel, mining, and utility industries. Frank has been investigating new sources of energy for 20 years. His papers have been published in numerous places, including Infinite Energy Magazine and the Journal of New Energy. Welcome, Frank.
Scott and Tom, it's a pleasure to be on your show, and I have some interesting things to tell you.
Oh,
that's
good.
Great. That's great.
Glad to have you. Hey, Frank, how you doing? I want to ask you a question about the history of cold fusion and where it started from, where it went to, and did it ever really die, or did it just die in the mainstream?
Well, thank you. That's a good question. There was reports of cold fusion in the 1920s, but they were never really followed through with. A big discovery was made by Pons and Fleischmann, and they got a palladium electrode, and they put in heavy water, deuterium, and they got through this electrolysis process, they got a lot of anomalous energy. But it worked some of the time, and other times it didn't work, and it was very sensitive to small impurities in the palladium, poisons that may affect the palladium, the grain structure of the palladium, the loading density of the heavy water into the palladium structure, and they had trouble with replication. And so the replications, a lot of them didn't work because they didn't follow the protocol. The second big thing that happened is it did not fit into the existing theoretical paradigm. Ordinarily, fusion happens when two nucleons come together and bump into each other. And when they come together, they have to overcome their electrostatic repulsion. And that takes energies of the order of four times the interior of the sun. The surface of the sun is not hot enough for fusion. And to think that fusion is happening on the tabletop at low energies is quite impossible. And so based on these theoretical constructs that many feel are well understood, it was rejected. And from that point, it sort of fell into disfavor, and Pons and Fleischmann, who really got a really great thing going, actually ended their careers in disgrace.
Right. So you think that their experiment in and of itself was a success?
Yes, some of the experiments were a success. One of the experiments actually melted the palladium, but they didn't understand the theory of it. They didn't understand exactly what they were doing. They were sort of shooting in the dark. So sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And in science, we'd like to have 100% reproducibility. And this is an extraordinary claim, that they were getting fusion reactions at room temperature. So it requires extraordinary proof, and they could not provide it.
Right. Okay. So some people came along later and discredited them. What do you think, that was a malicious act, or was it just mainly the scientific community that couldn't reproduce it, so therefore it fell by the wayside?
Well, a lot of inventors have been producing perpetual motion machines since the 1700s, and these things generally don't work. They violate things called the principle of increasing of entropy and conservation of momentum, and so the patent office right now rejects all claims that appear to be perpetual motion. And so Pons and Fleischmann's invention appeared to fit into this fringe aspect of scientific discovery. But that's not exactly true. Pons and Fleischmann were one of the world's leading electrochemists. And when they said they had something, we should have believed it, but we didn't.
Right. So we should have paid more attention to what they were doing and then carried on with it and made any sort of changes that needed to be made through experimentation to come up with a working model. So what happened from there? From that point on, I'm sure there's more history.
Oh, yeah. That's when I started to get involved. I wasn't involved with Pons and Fleischmann, but a guy named James Patterson produced an energy cell through his company, Clean Energy Technologies. And I actually went out to see Patterson at PowerGen 95. That's where he had a public expose. And his machine was working, producing about 1 kilowatt of energy at that time. He got a patent through because he's an older fella, and they gave special considerations for someone that's older because they don't have 20 years to wait to get their patent. The right. device was sent to the University of Illinois, and Professor George Miley, who's a good friend of mine now, actually replicated the results, and he also discovered the excess energy. And I've met with Miley, and he invited me to come out to the University of Illinois where I spoke on the subject. Now, what Miley found, which was even more amazing, was the transmutation of heavy elements. He found that elements in the middle of the periodic table, like copper, zinc, and tin, they were transmuting. And the energies required to transmute these elements, according to conventional theories, aren't found in the interior of the sun. They're only found in a supernova explosion. And so when he reported transmutation of heavy elements, the story became even more unbelievable to the mainstream establishment, and they rejected these claims out of hand.
Okay. Now, was that a correct thing to do? Were they correct in rejecting it?
Well, science is an empirical subject. It's not like a religion where you go back to the original book to find the ultimate truth. You do an experiment, and it produces a result, and you have to, you know, build your science based on these observable results. And throughout history, observable results have changed things. For instance, Aristotle believed in many things like the continuum of nature. Newton came along and he did experimental results with motion and resulted in Newton's laws of motion. And he got to this because the thing that they had was a telescope, so they can look how the planets move. That's how he developed his laws. And then in the 1900s, they thought that all of physics was solved and complete, but then they started getting these spectral emissions and quantum jumps in atoms. Niels Bohr started to discover that, and that was a new paradigm. And these experimental conditions did not fit within the existing structure, and so the structure had to be changed. But now we feel that we know enough that the structure is well established on solid foundation, and these cold fusion results don't fit in there. And once again, I think what we're going to see is a paradigm change. Now we have new observable results beyond those of the atomic spectrum that are going to change not only the way that we live and the way we produce energy, but the way that physics is taught in future books.
Right. But one of the problems is, or one of the reoccurring themes, let's say, is whenever the paradigm shift happened, there's large groups of current scientists that have problems rewiring their brain to accept those paradigm shifts and rejection and denial, and all of these incredible human traits pop out, and they'll deny it until they make their own paradigm shift and go, okay, well, I guess that's right. You know, that's a human element that we have to deal with, right?
Yes. Chief among these is Dr. Robert Parks. He's the head of the American Physical Society, and he publishes his weekly newspaper called What's New, and he's been bashing cold fusion from day one. And he got together with Peter Zimmerman from the State Department, and they ruined careers. University professors and other people who wanted to do honest scientific exploration and to see if this cold fusion exists, they actually cut their funding. The people were disgraced. Papers were not allowed to be published. The whole field was held back because they felt it didn't fit within their theoretical construct. And so it must be something that is ridiculous in their mind. And they really held back the field for 20 years. And I felt they've done irreversible damage to our environment, because we should have had new energy 20 years ago. irreversible damage to our economy. A lot of people are homeless, falling off the bottom of the ladder, and the cost of energy is one thing that's pushing our standard of living down. Mm-hmm. And I hope that when this all shakes out, that the people that held us back will be known in the mainstream media.
Well, we're sorry, but we got to take a quick break right now, and we'll see you guys on the other side.
Are you suffering from constant pain in the knee, shoulder, wrist, and other parts of your body? Needle-free acupuncture with Lapingo Life Pads may be the answer. Lapingo Life Pads combine ancient wisdom with modern nanotechnology and advanced engineering. They're designed to relieve pain naturally with no needles and no side effects. That's Lepingo, lapingoproducts.com.
If you suffer or know someone that suffers from back pain, knee pain, or any other chronic or sports-related pains, you need to visit LapingoProducts.com. Dealing with pain can affect every aspect of your life, which is why our products are designed to bring you real relief. Our products are not only easy to use, effective, and safe for the entire family, but our prices are competitive and offer a complete satisfaction guarantee. Visit LapingoProducts.com, real life solutions for pain-free living.
So, Frank, tell me more about the Patterson Power Cell.
Well, when I went to see the Patterson Power Cell in Anaheim, I was truly amazed by it, and I wished I could have been either Senior James Patterson or the Junior Jim Patterson, because I thought they had the world in front of them. They felt the same thing. Motorola actually offered them $60 million for their equipment, but they turned it down because they felt they could make more money. Well, what happened with their device is similar to what happened in many cold fusion devices. They didn't quite understand the technology. And they made additional batches of beads, and they didn't quite work out. And James, the old, elder James, was working on it, and he's since deceased. And young Jim, to my dismay, had a brain aneurysm, and he died. So the Patterson technology had some problems with reproducibility that they weren't aware of initially. And the people that started it came to an unnatural end. And this was really a good story, and I thought it was the beginning of cold fusion, but it was just one step along the way.
But has anybody taken over their work?
Nobody's really done it. There's a group of papers and other information that a friend of mine has that he's working with the Patterson family. I understand the widow Patterson's trying to hold some of this stuff back. There's been a lot of people that invested in the technology at various phases, and they also claim ownership to the technology. So it's I don't know exactly what's going on, but the Patterson Power Cell technology didn't catch on and never reached commercial development.
So did they ever have a working model?
Yes, they did. When I went out to PowerGen 95, that was in Anaheim, California, I witnessed a cold fusion cell with about a milliwatt in of electrolysis energy, producing 1 kilowatt of electrical energy. And that was with their good beads. And the device producing 1,000 watts, I thought was quite a breakthrough. And I felt that was the moment that the world changed. So did they, but nobody realized that there was some small element in these beads, maybe an impurity, maybe grain size, thickness that had to be just right in order to get the device to work. And there's been some variables that emerged later on. It could be with where they bought the palladium that affected it. And these problems have never been solved.
And has something was learned from their work?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I learned a great deal. One of the things that I observed was the grain size was about 50 nanometers. And I saw that again and again. I saw that in the experiments with Errata, who used a 50 nanometer palladium black. Les Case is another experimenter who used nanometer-sized grains. I also noticed that when Patterson got his cell working, he had to use a preheater. And the preheater puts a little bit of heat in it, and it's low-grade thermal energy. It should have nothing to do with nuclear reactions. But I multiplied the thermal frequency, which is 10 to the 14 hertz, times the diameter of the grain size, 50 nanometers, and I got a velocity of 1 million meters per second. And I said, that velocity is important. But I didn't know what it was at that time. But I felt I'd stumbled upon something there with the preheater and the grain size, but I wasn't sure of the ramifications at that time.
Right. Okay, well, let's go a little bit into the future. From Patterson, where would we go next from Patterson?
Where I went next was to NASA Marshall. A guy named Evgeny Podkletnov had spun a superconducting disk, and he got a gravitational anomaly at the University of Tampere. And a guy came in smoking a pipe, and the smoke rose above the superconducting disk.
Ah, yes, I know about that. Carry on.
And then he went up to the floor above. They thought maybe it was a thermal gradient, and they blew smoke, and they saw that this effect went right through the floor. And so after I went down to Anaheim to visit with Patterson, I drove up to NASA Marshall, and a guy named Whit Brantley, he's the head of the Advanced Concepts Office, invited me to come in and look at their Podkletnov replication experiments. And what I found out was the disk size was about a third of a meter, and they were, Podkletnov suggested stimulating it at 3 megahertz. And so one third of a meter times 3 megahertz is 1 million meters per second. So the same velocity that I saw in the cold fusion experiment then emerged in the anti-gravity experiment. I still didn't know what it was, but I felt that this was something significant.
Right. So you're connecting the dots at that point. Great.
Yes, I'm connecting the dots now. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but I think I'm right. And there was something going on in both of these experiments. Now, the NASA Marshall team, Robert Parks, got on them big time, and they had $500,000 in funding, and it was cut. Also, there was a woman, Ning Li, who had her own theory, and she didn't want to spin the disk or apply the radio frequency energy. So the Podkletnov experiment, the fundings were cut for it, and it was never fully replicated at NASA.
So that's a little odd, don't you think? It had a result. It showed a result that was scientifically interesting. And you could get something from that. You would think that they would go and throw another $1 million on it at that point, don't you, Frank?
Well, I hope they would have, because it's important that we get off this planet and to the stars, and this is one technology that would enable that. The problem is the gravitational force is very weak, 10 to the 39th power weaker than the electromagnetic. And to get a strong gravitational anomaly from a spinning superconductive disk was scientific heresy, so it didn't fit into existing theoretical constructs. But this line of work has been continued at the European Space Agency. They appear to be a little open-minded. And a guy named Martin Timor, who I met last year in Washington, has also detected gravitational anomalies coming from spinning superconductors. These anomalies are very small. They also put a spacecraft in orbit called the Gravity Probe B that was supposed to detect gravitational anomalies from the Earth, and all the gyroscopes tended to line up. They were superconductive gyroscopes, and they found they're interacting through some kind of large gravitational anomaly, like the thing saw by Podkletnov. So that there's interesting things that have just emerged under the surface, but nobody has really connected the dots. But I think we're very close to having a breakthrough on these fields.
Great. Tom, do you have a question?
I wanted to expand more on those findings and on the anti-gravity. What is the future for that?
Well, I think the future is great for the anti-gravity, and I think the future is great for the cold fusion. Now, what I think is these are not separate events. This is one new underlying phenomenon. And what happens, if I can explain a little bit about a magnet, is a magnetic force is not conserved. If you turn a magnet on, the magnetic field emerges. When you turn it off, it disappears. Now, we can amplify these magnetic effects by putting soft iron into the magnet. And that's what Nikola Tesla did when he made a transformer. He put soft iron in the magnet. That's what Siemens did when he made an alternator. He put soft iron in the magnet. Edison also put soft iron in the generator. So we know how to amplify the electromagnetic force, the magnetic component. But all the fields have magnetic components. The gravitational field has a gravitomagnetic component, and the nuclear force has a magnetic component called the nuclear spin orbit force. And I think we've now discovered the material that can amplify the magnetic components of these quartz, of these forces. And that means that we'll be able to control all the natural forces. So what's emerging is a new understanding, not just of cold fusion and gravitomagnetism, but how to control each of the natural forces in the way that we currently controlled electromagnetism. I believe we're on the verge of a very significant technical revolution.
And how does that apply to, you know, that anti-gravity, if that was to become a reality, how will that apply to our understanding of the speed of light?
I don't think it would affect the understanding of the speed of light, but it would enable us to produce a strong gravitomagnetic field that we could use for propulsion. Also, it would be able to produce a strong nuclear spin orbit magnetic field for energy production. So we're learning how to control magnetism, which is a non-conserved property of the universe, control the magnetism of the other forces. Now, remember when I told you about two nucleons coming together and they have to be banged together with sufficient energy? Right. That's just to overcome the original Coulombic, the electrostatic force. But there's another force in the nuclear environment. It's a magnetic component. It's not of electromagnetic origin. It's of nuclear origin. When you move a nuclear field, you get a nuclear magnetic component. And this component is generally ignored except in considering stability of atoms. It was never considered to be mutable. But now we're finding out that that force is mutable, and we increase the strength of it. We can get nuclear reactions through the Coulombic potential well and produce nuclear reactions by an unconventional manner.
Okay. But is it possible, based on this type of ideas now, that the speed of light could be achieved or greater than?
Well, I don't know if we could go faster than the speed of light. I sort of doubt it. But when you have a gravitomagnetic field induced, obviously gravity affects inertia. They're tied together. And so can we change the inertial frame of a traveling body through a gravitomagnetic field? I don't know that. Only thing I'm studying is can we produce this gravitomagnetic field? But once we have it, we have a strong local gravitational field that's 10 to the 39th power stronger than we expect. We may be able to explore inertia modification. And I don't have any idea where this goes. Mm-hmm. Just like the original works in electromagnetism could not predict the emergence of a modern computer, learning to control each of the natural forces, I don't know where this is going to wind up. But I'm sure it's going to go into many new marvelous technologies.
Well, that's the beauty of it, isn't it? Where do we go from there? Where are we at present day now in your story?
Yeah, we're present day, and you might want to ask me about Andrea Rossi.
Oh, good, Andrea Rossi. I would like to know about Andrea Rossi. There's some stuff going on in Greece right now that you're aware of. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. Cold fusion has been a field that's been very fickle. It produces small amounts of energy. The Navy produced some. Navy SPAWAR produced some. And extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And the thing that works some of the time produces small amounts of energy. There's always some doubt. Is your instrument off? Is it out of calibration? Did we have a chemical reaction with something burning in there? And so it was never quite believed. And it never quite made it to commercial realization. Even Patterson had his device, it worked, but it didn't work. He didn't know quite why. But this fellow named Andrea Rossi in Italy was fooling around with nickel electrodes, and he was putting carbon dioxide and hydrogen in there, trying to make synthetic fuels through catalytic interaction. And he got a large energy gain. And now we found cold fusion with ordinary hydrogen, not heavy hydrogen, and a very inexpensive metal, not palladium, but nickel. And Rossi's device has produced 15 kilowatts of energy with only a little bit of energy going in, maybe 100 watts that he uses to control this device. And I'm very optimistic about his device because it fits in within the paradigm that I'm thinking of. He has the nanometer structures, which are about 50 nanometers in size, and he's stimulating them thermally. So this velocity that I observed in the cold fusion and the gravitational experiments is also apparent in Rossi's device. So it's consistent with what has happened in the past, but this time it's commercial.
Okay.
And that's happening right now in Greece. Is there a big unveiling happening right now, or is there some hoops that they got to jump through? And
well, there's always hoops, but there was recently a big unveiling where Rossi presented his experiment at the University of Bologna in Italy, and that's a very, very large university. And it was reviewed by scientists. One of the guys is Sinelli. He's a well-known cold fusion researcher. Another guy was Focardia, I believe his name is, and Levi. And these guys have made news releases that are running now in Italy, Greece, throughout Europe. However, we don't hear much about it in the United States. And I'm hoping that we start to hear about this in the mainstream news here.
So you're saying that although this is a big, huge event in your eyes, that we're not hearing about it in North America. It's silence dead over here.
Not only is it dead over here, North America is holding it back. They will not grant Rossi a patent. And he needs a patent in order to protect his rights. He come up with an invention, he deserves to make some money. And he can't put that invention out there without any patent protection. And our patent office has classified his device as perpetual motion and will not give him a patent. So in this very moment when we need an energy breakthrough, when we're reaching an oil peak, we're having unrest in the Middle East, we're having economic crisis, the patent office has stopped him. And I wish this wouldn't happen.
Right. So would this unit be a one-time, let's take it into the household. Let's say that it gets to a point, maybe 10 years from now, where these units are available for household use. Would this be a one-time purchase? You buy it, you put it in your basement, it powers your area. Or is there a way that they're going to put a meter on this bad boy?
Well, that's a question, because if it's nuclear, the Nuclear Regulatory Agency will put the kibosh on it. But at the same time, when they put the kibosh on it for being nuclear, the patent office will put the kibosh on by saying it doesn't work at all. So if it doesn't work at all, it can't be nuclear. But it is working, and it's produced very little, if no, nuclear products. But until they really can confirm that there's no radiation coming off of this, even in small amounts, it'll probably remain in an industrial environment.
Right.
And it'll take a while to work out the bugs. It's a high-pressure device. It could explode. One of the devices ran away. It was supposed to produce 15 kilowatts, jumped up to 130 kilowatts. So there's a lot of issues before we put it into a home environment where the homeowner isn't familiar with technology.
Okay.
It's already been in Greece now, and it heated a factory now, I understand, for 1 year. So it has worked.
It has worked. Yeah, I guess my point is where is it going to fall? Is it going to fall within the realm of the J.P. Morgans saying to Tesla, if I can't put a meter on it, it ain't going to happen? Or is it going to fall into the realm of you put it in your factory or you put it in your home, wherever the case may be, and there is no meter? It's a one-time purchase. You buy it, it works. Are we going, does this have the availability to go into that area that we've never been before? Because I don't know about you, but I pay a monthly energy bill.
Oh, yes, it does. I expect it to be quite similar to the Internet, where it was very expensive, only universities have it, and now the Internet is almost free. We're talking here, and things are published and transmitted in large databases. So the cost will slowly go down. The biggest secret about the atomic bomb was that it was possible. And when Rossi comes out and demonstrates this and the world knows it's possible, there's going to be a lot of research and a lot of other avenues. I believe it's actually possible to produce, instead of thermal energy, produce electrical energy directly from these devices.
Right. So if that's the case, and you can put a loop on it where it powers itself, that gets rid of the meter. Meter gone.
Yeah, meter gone. It changes the entire structure of our society. That's the Achilles heel of our industrial society. We have a living standard that we enjoy today because energy does a lot of the work. And in the Western civilization has been based on applying more and more energy to automate and make things better. And we've developed many things, amazing things, in the field of electronics, controls. Watson was on TV. He's a computer that's miraculous. But we haven't done much in energy. I was at a decommissioning of a power plant. I start power plants up. 1925, I recognized all the parts in the old power plant. It hasn't changed much. We're still burning stuff. But this technology could produce a revolution where energy is too cheap to measure, and that'll lift everybody up. And I'm looking for a very good time for humanity for the next 20 to 50 years.
Now, we know that there could be a possible problem with that, in the effect that if there's meter gone concept, if that does, you know, say 5 years, 10 years, 15, whatever the case may be, once we get to that point, the people who make money in the oil industry and the fossil fuel industry and stuff like that, I suppose they can go into other areas to make money, like production of units, maintenance of units. But if there's no meter, they're not making a monthly stipend, as it were. So they would have to go into another area. You would think that they would be highly opposed to this, at least until they can get around it so that they're making money off this technology.
I don't think they're opposed to it. They just don't believe it. We'll find out if they're opposed to it when it starts making commercial headway.
Right.
And I expect that to happen by the end of the year. Right now, nobody believes it. There's been a lot said that the oil-producing countries will be opposed to it, but I doubt it. A lot of the main oil fields that are producing oil, like Qatar in Saudi Arabia, are 50 years old, and they're using increasingly better technologies to extract the oil. But sooner or later, we're going to reach a peak. We want to conserve the oil that we have left for making plastics and other things. We don't want to burn it. So I think they'll be very glad that the last drop of oil won't be burned up, and they'll have a sustainable future in these countries.
Right. That's what we can hope. We can hope that they're not thinking with their pocketbook, and they'll just move into these other new areas of energy. So that'll be good.
But considering that, you know, they had a unit working, why is it so difficult for the North American scientists to pay attention to this a little bit more?
Well, Rossi's keeping it a secret. He doesn't want to send it out too far where somebody's going to take it apart and see what he has in there, because he can't get a patent. He says once he gets a patent, he'll be able to send devices out because there's a lot of money involved here. Somebody finds out a secret, they change the recipe a little bit, and they claim it's theirs. It's something different. So he's playing a game now as an inventor. A lot of people that invent things at the very initial first invention don't make out. Their inventions are stolen. And somebody else takes it. I believe Samuel Morse might not have been the guy that built the first telegraph. Somebody else had 90% of it. Morse added a little bit to it, and the other guy, I don't even know his name, because that's what happened to him. He's gone.
It's interesting. Okay, so are you going to be doing anything? Are you going to be presenting anything, writing any papers on this?
Yeah. I'll be in Washington, D.C. on March 16th at University of Maryland. Tom Vallone, and Glenn Robertson put together a conference. It's going to be huge. There's industry leaders there, people from many fields, and I'm going to present my paper, The Control of Natural Forces, where I explain this velocity that I've seen in cold fusion experiments, and I also applied this velocity to the atom, and I show that that's the velocity of the quantum transition. And using this velocity, I'm going to redevelop quantum physics and show the energy levels of the hydrogen atom, the intensity of spectral emission, the energy and frequency of a photon based on this cold fusion velocity. And this is different. This is new because quantum physics was based on the observation of spectral lines. We had no observables beyond that. Now we have a new one. We have this velocity that we've seen in this cold fusion and anti-gravity experiments. And incorporating that velocity into a model of quantum physics provides quite a new understanding, a basic understanding that will actually change how textbooks are written. So in order for this to happen, though, it's going to require extraordinary proof. But I'm very proud to be presenting in Washington, and I hope that things go well. But what happened there is I had a paper, me and Glenn Robertson from NASA Marshall.
Okay.
and the American Physical Society rejected all papers from this conference out of hand because somebody, we don't know who, is making an effort to shut this thing down. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sad state of affairs.
Now, those papers, all of the papers were rejected?
Every conference paper was rejected. Tell you the truth, there were some bad ones there, and there were some good ones there, but a conference paper is generally considered to be a lower standard than a published paper.
Of course.
And people come and talk about ideas. That's what the conference is for. Maybe their idea is bad, and maybe there's mostly bad, but there's one or two good points. And so we learn from talking and discussing and publishing these conference papers, and every paper has been shut down, and nobody knows quite why.
If you were to take a guess, why would you say that happened?
Well, if they look at some of the people there that are on the extreme, I would say their papers aren't that good. But there are some people there that are doing quite good work. One guy was talking about an ion thruster for an engine, and he was from the University of Auburn last time. Professor Miley was there talking about a fusion-powered rocket ship. He's a very competent individual. So these kind of papers are also being blocked. And sadly to say, my work has appeared in Infinite Energy magazine on the Internet, but the peer-reviewed journals are very reluctant to look in the direction that I'm going. And so it's really holding back this technology for a number of years. And unless Rossi comes through with a clear demonstration, it's going to continue to be the case.
Tell us more about Miley's work.
George Miley?
Yeah.
George Miley he was the editor for the American Nuclear Society. He's a nuclear physicist at the University of Illinois, professor. He's consulted. He's one of these guys that you consult when you're going to build something very nuclear, a power plant. And he replicated Patterson's work. He got some energy, 50 milliwatts. But he also got transmutations in heavy elements, which shouldn't occur at all, and it's really an unbelievable result. But what he produced in his cell was tritium, which is an element that's not natural. It's a radioactive isotope of hydrogen. And he also got elements with unnatural isotopic compositions. That means the nucleus had extra neutrons that they don't find in nature. And so these elements are definitely a result of some kind of nuclear reaction and not the result of some kind of contamination or instrument error because they're not found naturally. And these things were produced in Patterson's cell, and Miley presented it, but it really didn't attract the public notice that it should have.
Is that the creation? Is that like a creation of a new element?
No, elements have neutrons and protons. For instance, hydrogen has one proton and one neutron. Deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen, has one proton and two neutrons. And tritium has one proton and three neutrons. Well, tritium doesn't occur naturally anywhere. And when a device produces hydrogen with three neutrons in ultra-heavy hydrogen, then they have to be, where did it come from? It could only have come from a nuclear reaction. Now, there's very tiny quantities of this stuff produced. And so if you got other products like copper or other elements that are normal, you could say, well, it leaked in, maybe it came in with the water. But when you get something that's not in nature, naturally coming out of these experiments, then you know you have something. And this was done in the 90s. And it's
right.
Still taking this long to come out.
And in the cold fusion, is a similar idea is being produced?
Yeah, the cold fusion has produced elements with non-normal isotropic distribution, has produced tritium, which is a radioactive element in small quantities, has produced small quantities of energy. The problem is no one believes it because the energy isn't sufficient to cause elements to fuse. Now, what I say is I'm not considering the original force that pushes it. I'm considering the magnetic component of the nuclear force, which can be amplified under certain circumstances. And this is a new idea. It's used in electromagnetism all the time. We use soft iron to amplify the magnetism of an electromagnetic field. But there must be a material that amplifies the magnetic component of the strong nuclear force and of the gravitomagnetic force. And I think I found it. And that's his velocity. And I have a theorem. It says the constants of the motion, that says all the forces become equal, 10 to the electromagnetic, in a Bose condensate, that's a superconductor, that stimulated the dimensional frequency of 1 megahertz meter. That means if you get a superconductor and you shake it at the right frequency, you're going to get all these results.
Okay. But is the establishment right now, you know, has the periodical table been pretty much done? Like they don't think, you know, another element will be coming up at some point in time?
Well, cold fusion has not been successful in producing super heavy elements, but it has been successful in producing elements with neutrons, too many neutrons or too few neutrons that are not found ordinarily in matter. And I think that's a pretty big thing.
Yeah, that does sound like a pretty big deal. Where do you foresee, say 20 years, just where do you think we're going to be at if this is allowed to come out?
Well, I think it's the same story. We thought we were ahead of the Russians, and the Sputnik went around the world. It was a paradigm-changing event, and the United States had to run fast to catch up and even beat the Russians. And now we're sitting back. We think we know everything. Nobody could have a better answer than us. When Rossi's device becomes commercial, it's going to hit us like the Sputnik, and we're going to have to run very, very fast. And it's going to have to open up our minds to new ideas. How could nuclear reactions be occurring at low energies, especially ones involving heavy elements? There's going to have to be a fundamental reassessment of what's going on. And I think I have laid the groundwork for this in my papers. At least I hope I did. And I think what's going to emerge is we're going to learn how to control all the natural forces. Most of our technology today is involved in the control of electromagnetism. It has the right range and strength. So your speaker's vibrating and has a magnet, an electromagnet in it where you can hear me. But we can't control gravity because all you can do is fall down. But we're going to learn how to control gravity the same way we control electromagnetism and the strong nuclear force to get it to do what we want. And that'll be three times the technology. I think this is where this is going to end up. But I don't know how long it's going to take us to get there.
Right. So if we were to encapsulate this into the future of humanity, this could go a long way when it comes to space travel, all kinds of things. This could push humans out into space more so than we've been.
Well, we're in deep trouble now. Let's say like Saudi Arabia had a population of about 8 million in the 20s. Now they have a population equal to the population of Spain and increasing rapidly. And they don't have water, they don't have crops. And unless we get new technology to support the number of people on this planet in a clean way that doesn't damage the environment, we're in trouble. But these technologies will take us there. We'll take us off the Earth. We'll become children of the universe. We have a lot of places and a lot of things to do, and I think a very productive and bright future for the people of the Earth, not the dismal one that we hear in the news media.
Yeah, you do see a lot of doom and gloom and strife in the media and in the, you know, Hollywood and TV shows, and it always comes to a bad end. You know, we're always in a bad end, the end of the world, and then, you know, a few humans that are left get to go on. I don't accept that paradigm. The paradigm I see is of a planetary evolution. Planetary evolution, you have to eventually get to space. Has to happen.
Yes.
It's got to happen. I mean, where are you going to go?
But has the idea changed, you know, over the last 20, 30 years of the linear travel that, you know, has been going on for, you know, all these years?
Well, I don't know where we're going to get to, but we initial forays off the planet will be to the asteroids to mine them. Certainly, if we require nickel for our cold fusion cell, that'll be one of the first things we'll do. We can mine the moon for helium-3. That'll be a useful product.
Right.
We can get to Mars, do some things there. I'm looking forward to all this stuff when we have a new source of energy and propulsion. Now, the stars are a long ways off, and I'm sure we're going to get there, but I can't quite see that far. My vision doesn't extend that far. All I can see is the next step. But I'm quite sure that once the next step is made, that there will be others to follow.
I agree completely. Okay, well, I'm glad we got a chance to talk to you. Is there anything else you'd like to cover while you have the time?
Yes, anybody that's interested in my work can go to the General Journal of Physics and look up my paper, The Control of the Natural Forces, and that gives the mathematical formulations that relate cold fusion, anti-gravity, and atomic spectra all in one concise, about a 10-page paper. So that's what I have to contribute.
Okay. And again, where will you be speaking?
I'll be speaking at the International Space and Propulsion Forum at the University of Maryland, which extends from the 14th through the 18th of March. And I'm very excited about it.
Okay, that sounds good. And do you have a website?
Yes, I'm all over the web. The Alien Scientist did some really good videos on me.
Yep.
I have a website called Zero Point Technologies. If you put my name in, Frank Zendarsik, you'll find hundreds of links to papers, other publications, comments about my work. Most of these comments have become from the popular media or from media that aren't established. I'm having trouble making a beachhead in the peer-reviewed process because anything that mentions cold fusion or gravitational modification is immediately rejected, not even read. And as a matter of fact, I hope that this peer-reviewed process becomes obsolete throughout this process.
So you run into that personally. You personally run into the fact of things being ignored and pushed off to the side and not even considered.
Oh, yes. Professor Miley's papers have been rejected. There's been many groups that have papers. Even the Naval Weapons Lab, SPAWAR, has results, and that's the Navy. And there's all those people are all PhDs. They have trouble getting their papers out. They have to get them published in Europe because they won't be accepted here in the U.S. Now, that's a sad state of affairs.
That is a sad state of affairs. Absolutely, I agree 100%. It doesn't really speak well to science, does it? Or the current paradigm that science is in.
Yes. And if you look at what the president says, we're going to have windmills, we're going to have biomass. These things will work, but they're going to work at a very high cost, and our standard of living is going to be reduced. And the people that are going to be hurt the worst are the ones closest to the bottom of the ladder. They'll fall off. They won't be able to buy a new car or maintain their car and get to work. The middle class will be pushed down. The people at the top, the rich people, will be fine because they'll have enough money. But if you get a new source of energy, it'll be the United States in the 50s. Every year, bigger and better. You hope to do better than your parents, and your kids will even do better yet. I think that's where we're going.
I think that's where we're going too. Tom?
Yeah. Are any of these applications that could be put towards, fueling the car market and that sort of thing? Or is it specifically only for...
No, it would have to be a pretty small unit.
Small unit, yeah.
It would have to be a pretty small unit for a vehicle, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of like a steam engine. The first units will be cumbersome, will be stationary engines. As they get them lighter and more efficient, they'll appear in automobiles. And as they produce more energy with less weight, the last place they'll be is in airplanes and jets. And finally, they'll move into space.
Right. And then Well, hopefully that can happen. I mean, God knows gas prices are insane now. I feel like I'm being raped every time I pull up to a gas station.
You are being raped.
Oh,
it's all intentional.
Yes, I wish I could send you a bill, too.
Well, you guys don't pay as much as we do.
Yeah, we pay more in the Canada. I mean, our gas, it's $1.20 a liter today.
$1.23 to be exact.
Yeah, $1.23 a liter.
Wow.
Yeah, it's insane.
That's like about double the price of you guys.
Yes. Well, I hope to see the beginning of the end of this by the end of this year.
I don't know about that because, I mean, the thing is that they're always looking for a reason to jack up the prices, and it doesn't have to be a valid reason. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, they don't have reserves. I mean, they have more reserves than, you know, for the next 10 years. Never mind, you know, because Libya or, you know, whatever is going on in the and down that end, you know, and it's they're just using it as an excuse to make more money for themselves.
Yeah, the scarcity excuse. Yeah, it's the scarcity excuse.
Well, they're not even making that excuse right now. It's not a scarcity thing. It's the speculators going in and pumping up the prices.
Right.
And it happened before, like a couple of years ago when, you know, it went to $1.34 a liter. And we were saying, you know, what happened there? it's not like, you know.
Did you hear what some states are worried about with the electric car?
What?
How are they going to tax it?
Yeah.
They're putting a GPS unit on the car to track where everybody drives so they can bill them per mile of road. We don't even have any electric cars on the road yet, and they're already considering how to tax them.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So they're always going to try to find a way to make money out of it. I mean, you know, regardless of what technology we're going to come up with, you know, we're always going to be shafted in some way or the other.
Well, I mean, it's the J.P. Morgans of the world, you know. If I can't put a meter on it, it ain't going to happen. And they have more control than you do, you know, in the political sphere of things, because money talks and, you know, the politicians listen. So
the industries are too large, you know, and when if they're going to lose, they're not going to go for it.
Nah. You know, why would they want to affect their profit margin?
Exactly.
Why would they want to do that? I don't know. But I think a paradigm shift does have to happen. I don't know how it can happen. I'd like to run into somebody who can map that all out, how that can happen, a paradigm shift. What do you think, Frank? Is it going to happen?
Oh, yes. I'm a child of the energy crisis in the 70s, and that's when I started working on this. And at that time, it was King Coal. We were going to go to coal because that was our resource. We were going to get away from imported oil. And now we're getting away from coal. President Obama doesn't like coal because it produces greenhouse gases. Capturing these gases and pumping them underground is extraordinarily expensive. Getting out the other pollutants in coal, the sulfur and the mercury and everything else that's in it, including in the ashes, is really driving up the cost of coal-fired generation. So coal doesn't appear like it's going to be the king and save us. And we don't have enough oil in the United States. And we found some natural gas in the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania, but they're going to probably use those in utilities as they get away from coal. So it isn't the answer. But I believe this coal fusion thing is going to be a fundamental change, paradigm-changing thing that's going to change the energy production industry, just like the transistors, the invention of the transistors changed electronics. It's going to take a couple of years to unfold, but it's going to be very interesting. And fortunes are going to be made. So if you watch these companies and see which one has the right technology, it might be a good time to invest. Rossi's company is Deflac Kalon Technology. It's still a privately held company, and I don't know if I want to invest in it. I have to see a little more. But I'm keeping my eyes open because there's going to be new Microsoft born rather shortly.
Man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if they can get to that point and they open it up, it might be definitely a good investment. They just have to get by the pit bulls that are guarding the energy industry. You know, and they've had a lot of time to get very big and lots of muscles. So.
But, you know, I could see why, though, the smaller countries like Greece or, you know, are sort of taking on this sort of approach because they have a lot more to gain, whereas the... But you know, larger countries, you know, they there's so many big companies there that are in the energy fields that, you know, they will reject that for sure.
Well, I think they're eventually not going to have a choice, don't you, Frank? I mean, it's like you said with Sputnik, exactly. They're eventually not going to have a choice.
I think it's going to hit us on the head like a brick.
Yeah.
And I went with Professor Miley to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and he gave a dog and pony show, and I noticed that from Italy there was people coming from the Italian Atomic Energy, the official agency from Italy. So Italy has had a very open mind in promoting this kind of energy, whereas in the United States, if you think you're going that way, it's a career killer. But Miley managed to survive because he's an older guy and has his tenure. He'd have been a young professor, he'd have been in trouble too.
Right, yeah, I've heard that you can run into trouble if you're not tenured. Okay. Well, I think we've covered everything that we need to cover, unless you can think of something else.
I think if you got the scope of it, anybody wants to get into the math, read my papers, and just watch the news media. It's going to be one exciting trip.
That's right. And I will have a link to your website. I will have a link to your papers. And I'll also have a link to a couple of YouTube videos that are showing what's going on with Rossi.
Excellent.
On our upcoming and past guest section. So, again, I'd like to thank you for coming, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you, Scott and Tom. It's been a privilege.
It's our pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Spectrum.
Alternative Myth, Homeopathy, Secrets, Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO, Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanes and Scott Jordan.